Jesus said, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments, and I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate to be with you forever. This is the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him, because he abides with you, and he will be in you. I will not leave you orphaned. I am coming to you. In a little while, the world will see me no longer, but you will see me. Because I live, you also will live. On that day, you will know that I am in the Father, and you in me, and I in you. They who have my commandment and keep them are those who love me, and those who love me will be loved by my Father, and I will love them and reveal myself to them." The Gospel of our Lord.
So Jesus says, "I will not leave you orphaned." If you look back on this entire season of Easter, in addition to calling it the season of Easter, we could also call it the season of the Gospel of John. Starting on Easter Sunday, we had a little snippet from Matthew, but then we went into chapter 20, 21 of the Gospel according to John, the whole Thomas thing. And then little segue the following Sunday, Gospel according to Luke, story of Emmaus. But then, from then on, bam, it has been nothing but John's Gospel, chapter 10, with the whole Good Shepherd thing. Last Sunday, our fave, in chapter 14, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." Always a fun moment for us. We'll come back to that in a minute. And then today, Jesus letting his friends know, "I will not leave you orphaned." You get the impression that he's going, bye-bye, I hope. And we'll hear more about that even next Sunday, the last Sunday of Easter, from chapter 17 of the Gospel according to John. So here we are in the thick of it. And I have to tell you, folks, when we were at the cathedral last Sunday, it dawned on me, you know, every week for years now, Sunday comes and goes, and at the end of our Sunday services, I go home, I take a little nap, I get up, I pull out the lessons for the next Sunday, and I start to read them. And I've been doing that for years. It's part of my prayer life. It's part of my prayer and meditation discipline. I mean, that's the sort of setting out of which, you know, sermons come and go. And at the cathedral, it hit. It was like, wait a minute. I haven't been working on this sermon from the 14th chapter of the Gospel of John for a week. I have been working on this sermon for about 35 years. Because when I was in seminary, I remember the summer before, some old-timer said, "Hey, read the Bible before you go to seminary." Big mistake. More confusing than it was enlightening or enlivening. And then there we are doing Bible content, scripture content for an entire year, got buried in this stuff. And I come out of the first year going, you know what? We could jettison the Gospel according to John and the Revelation to John, and we wouldn't miss a beat. And an old-timer heard me say that and said, "Well, it's a good thing we didn't ask you." And so from then on, I have had to wrestle with this thing. The Gospel according to John has driven me nuts over the years. It has given me fits and starts. It has given me insomnia. It has given me heartburn. It's like an alligator that won't go back into the water. I mean, over and over and over again, I've had to wrestle with this thing. So you're going to get 35 years worth right now. And as I've wrestled with it, unlike most what I refer to as surface readings, where you come across a line like, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. And the surface reading goes, ha-ha, everybody who doesn't believe in Jesus, and connect, you know, you're out of the fold. I mean, is baloney. I mean, it's absolute garbage because it's a surface reading. John's gospel, you gotta dig deep. And I've been doing it for years. And here it comes. First, some background. And we've talked a little bit about this, but I think it helps to know what's going on behind the scenes. This is the first century of the Common Era. It's some three, probably four generations removed from the time of Jesus, so any of the stories that you find in John's Gospel have been handed down through generations. And this particular Gospel grew out of a community that had been kicked out of its worship space, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But first, the big background setting is that the temple in Jerusalem has been destroyed in the mid-60s of the Common Era, and every Jewish person on the planet has been put into a tailspin. Okay, they have to figure out how to hold this thing together now. And all of the ways in which they've been Jewish people are no longer working. And so they're redefining their faith. And the people who comprised the community out of which the gospel according to John grew are primarily Jewish people. Jesus was a Jewish guy. I hope you remember that. Okay, good. So here they are in the throes of these massive tectonic shifts in terms of their religious tradition and faith. And that's one. Oh, and just as an aside, and the Pharisees won, by the way, because it was Pharisaic Judaism that was the quickest on its feet that became the seedbed for what we now call Judaism in the world in its various forms. But it is the system of the Pharisees that was able to hold Judaism together and became rooted in both families and in worship of the synagogue. So it's all up for grabs. And not only was John's gospel formed during those kinds of tectonic shifts, but all of the Christian scriptures happened during that time. It's like the ground is shifting under them. Nothing is solid. And then, in this little fledgling community, and by the way, as we've pointed out before, this is a minority report, not a majority report, okay? That's important to remember about all of the Gospels. But here in this fledgling little community, there are these Jewish folks and maybe Gentile converts, which is a whole other kettle of fish, who have attached themselves to Jesus and the memory of Jesus and the stories about Jesus and this whole invitation to live this life of death and resurrection. And as a result of that, they get kicked out of their worshiping community. Imagine that. Let's use an example. All the people who are involved in the wine walk, raise your hands. Or if you show up on occasion for the wine walk, raise your hand. There you go. I knew I was looking at Dick in particular. Yeah. So let's say we decide that we're going to target all the wine walkers and we're going to kick them out of St. Peter's. For no other reason that they're involved in the wine walk. Brian? Oh, he's leaving. Yeah. Never trust a four-eyed literalist. And I mean, imagine where that would leave you. I mean, it would leave the larger community, the rest of us, a bit confused and concerned, maybe a little scared, right? But those who have been kicked out, you'd be downright hurt. You'd be mad. You'd be sad. You'd be angry. You would feel betrayed, would you not? And not only that, but you'd also start waiting for the other shoe to drop. Oh my God, says you folks, if doing the wine walk can get us in this kind of trouble at St. Peter's, what's going to happen when we end up somewhere else? Okay, this is key to understanding the nature of the gospel according to John. Because these people, these followers of Jesus, these Jewish and Gentile converts who have attached themselves to the memory of Jesus, they're afraid in addition to being angry. And this is the group out of which the gospel according to John was generated. In other words, it is fear talking to fear. Are you with me so far? All right. It's no wonder that we end up with phrases and sentences like, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. That is a voice of fear from the gospel according to John, speaking to the fear of those who have been kicked out of their worship place and space. The point being, those are first century problems. They are not 21st century problems. Are you with me so far there? Okay. So you and I do not have to go down that rabbit hole. In other words, we can identify those points in the gospel that are the voice of fear and go, yeah, thanks a lot. But we're going to keep moving, and we're going to claim the larger and the deeper message, which, as you folks already know, is a message of love, compassion, mercy, forgiveness, grace, right? And love. Don't forget love. Nothing gets by Dick. Do you see how this, pardon me? Wine and a meal, always. So, yay, the wine walkers are back. Woohoo! We get to embrace them and love them and party with them and make fun of them. And they keep winning best of wine walk, and I keep getting the resentment from the other downtown business, whatever. I mean, we're having a good time doing that, right? On it goes. So, again, it is just, it behooves us, as I've done for the last 35 years, to dig in with this thing and wrestle the alligator in order to understand the deeper meaning of this gospel and its message and its power for us today. Okay? Okay, so, with all that in the background, Jesus says, I will not leave you orphaned. And just prior to that, he says, I will ask the Father, and he will give you another, pay attention to the words, another advocate is the translation, today's translation, the Greek word being parakletos. The Father will give you another parakletos. And this parakletos is this thing, this essence, this presence of God. And here's a little trick. Again, you really got to go digging to find this one. Back to the first chapter, the prologue of the Gospel according to John, embedded in there, and you remember, in the beginning was the Word and wisdom, and the Word and wisdom were with God, and the Word and wisdom were God. Remember all that? The prologue? Embedded in that prologue is the suggestion that the parakletos is none other than Jesus. So, in effect, what he says now in the 14th chapter is, I will ask the Father, and he will give you another Jesus. He will give you another me to be with you forever. And if you take this and run it backwards and forwards all the way through the gospel according to John, you discover one very interesting little thing. That the gospel according to John, in a different way, but for similar reasons, the gospel according to Matthew, it does not support the idea of a second coming. In John's gospel, there's no second coming. Because Jesus says, well, you're going to get this thing, this essence, this presence, and it's going to be just like me, and you're going to be just fine, because we are not going to leave you orphaned. So, if there are any here present who've been, maybe a little abused, a little frightened by the whole threat of the second coming, oh my God, Jesus is coming, look busy, you know, that whole thing, and boy, when he comes, are you going to be in trouble, blah, blah, blah. I mean, if you've been on the receiving end of that and have wondered where it even comes from, I'm here to tell you there are two entire gospels that don't even support the idea. So you can just toss it if you want. Okay? Interesting little tidbit. So, where are we? On that day you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. And you may have observed over these last few Sundays, Betty taking her sweet old time reading these various passages, because they go around and around and around like a spiral, or, better yet, elliptical in nature. They're hard to read. They just are. I mean, because you can't, half the time you don't know who's talking, what's in reference to, who's I, who's we, who's they, who's us, who's you. It just kind of goes, the language sort of spirals, it swirls on purpose. The deep invitation of the gospel according to John is to accept the invitation into what I like to think of as an elliptical connection between God, Jesus, Parakletos, which can be translated advocate, comforter, cajoler, poker, connector, spirit. I mean, there's at least a dozen or more attributes that can be assigned to this essence, this presence that Jesus promises, that will not leave any generation orphaned. Okay? And so you and I are invited into that kind of an elliptical relationship. Some more courageous souls, not me included, would describe this as mystical Christianity. It's a mystical union that takes place. But those are highfalutin words, and we'll let the Christian mystics sort those out. Go talk to Lloyd after the service. He can dial you into that. So these elliptical connections, of which you and I are already a part. And if you take the gospel according to John to its extended conclusion, not only are we a part of God, but all of creation is as well. We're in this union, if you will. And when you and I gather, like we have today on any given Sunday or any day of the week, and we celebrate the Eucharist, that is precisely what we are claiming, that we are in on this elliptical connection. Father, Son, Spirit, us, creation. Are you with me? All right. You're getting 35 years here, condensed. Now, the heart of the message is love one another, correct? I mean, that's John's spin on the great commandment. Love God, love your neighbor as yourself. Love one another, says Jesus. And we go, oh, yeah, sure, that's so easy. Ah. Until we begin to look at the implication of that and what's required of us. And the most powerful image in the Gospel according to John takes place one chapter earlier than where we are right now, chapter 13, that begins what's known as the farewell discourse. Jesus going, okay, bye-bye, not going to leave you orphaned, but I got to go now. Chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, he's talking to his friends. Not 12 guys, but a whole bunch of people, men, women, and children, saying he's got to go, love one another, and, oh, by the way, says Jesus, let me show you what that looks like. And in chapter 13, he does this astonishing thing. He does not institute the Eucharist. There is no do this in remembrance of me in John's gospel. What he does stuns his friends. They're gathered for a meal. He's saying farewell. He takes off his tunic. He kneels in the dirt. And he washes their feet. And then turns to them and says, okay, boys and girls, now love like this. Imagine, I know we've said this before, but it's worth repeating. Imagine if every Sunday we gathered here to celebrate the Eucharist, and every Sunday we washed each other's feet. Some of us are breaking out in a sweat going, oh my God, the toenails. But think about, I mean, imagine how this would form who we are, how we treat each other, and how we approach the rest of the world. Washing each other's feet, and now, says Jesus, love like this. No wonder his friends freaked out. And all that stuff in John's gospel about belief, believe in the Father, believe in me, those who believe, all the, you know, the word keeps popping up in John's gospel, believe, believe, believe. And we, you and I, have been told over the years that that has to do with some kind of intellectual assent. Oh, we have to say these words, and we have to say them this way. Of course, good Episcopalians, if you confronted them, say, oh, what do you believe? I believe in God the Father, Almighty, Creator of heaven and earth. I believe in Jesus Christ. I mean, we just start reciting the creed, right? But then if you were to ask that same question of an evangelical or a fundamentalist Christian, they're putting on their war paint, and they're going to go hunt down every last living person who doesn't believe like them, right? And then now it's war. And again, all of that misses the point. Every time in John's gospel you and I hear the word believe or believing or belief, we can substitute the phrase be in relationship with. And so the invitation is, again, it's that elliptical connection. Believe in the Father. Be in relationship with the Father. Believe also in me. Be in relationship with me. Do you see how this works? Forget the surface reading. We're going deep, folks. So we're back to the elliptical connection, that whole set of relationships in which you and I have already claimed our place. Now, here comes the real challenge. Earlier, at the beginning of chapter 14, last Sunday's reading, Jesus says, "Let not your hearts be troubled." And it dawned on me that that I kind of have this troubled heart. In the last few years, I have been confronted by some childhood memories that prior to now I hadn't accessed before for good reason. And I have discovered that there are some people in my life that I have yet to forgive. And so for years, for decades, I mean, my God, people, I'm in my early 60s. You'd think I would have gotten my act together already, but here I am still carrying this unforgiving heart. Really? And so, not just in the 14th chapter, but all throughout John's Gospel, when Jesus says, don't let your hearts be troubled. And oh, by the way, when we're in relationship, we are choosing to give our hearts. Jesus has given his heart to us. God has given God's heart to us, the Spirit, on it goes. Now, in return, we give our hearts to God and Jesus and the Spirit and all of creation. But here's the beauty and the power of this gospel. It turns out it doesn't matter what kind of shape our hearts are in. You might have an unforgiving heart too. You might have a troubled heart. You may have a trampled heart. You may have a broken heart. You may have a hardened heart. It turns out it doesn't matter. Jesus has already invited us into the elliptical connection and all the attendant relationships, and you and I can bring our hearts in whatever shape they're in. And so, just so you know, every time we gather now on Sundays, I'm bringing my unforgiving heart. And in the hopes that through our connection with God and Jesus and the Spirit and each other and all of creation, that this unforgiving heart can be healed. Yay. Okay. I'm sure there's more of that 35 years, but I'm going to let it go right there. Take a nice deep breath.